Hello, and welcome to the Degree of Freedom podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and in a few moments we'll be joined by the team behind The Ancient Greek Hero, the long-running Harvard class that has become one of the most talked-about MOOCs on the internet. Greek Hero, or Hero X as the Harvard X team likes to call it, has 30,000 enrolled, giving Greg Nagy, the professor who's taught the course at both Harvard and Harvard Extension for decades, the chance to reach a huge audience of avid Iliad fans, or just those who've always had an interest or fascination with the classics, looking for an opportunity to read and interact with the works of Homer, Hesiod, Herodotus, and other figures whose names don't necessarily begin with the letter H. I'll admit to falling into that fascinated category, given that my return to college-level learning came via the classics. It was 2009 when I stumbled on Mike Duncan's History of Rome podcast, a program that captured huge audiences hungry for information on history's greatest empire that also inspired countless people to try their hand at self-propelled learning, teaching, and podcasting. From there, it was a trip down ancient memory lane with classes from iTunes, great courses, and elsewhere on ancient history, literature, and philosophy, an interest that led directly to the Degree of Freedom one-year philosophy BA project. But none of these traditional lecture courses prepared me for the unique experience of being involved with Nagy and his team's Greek Hero course. Longtime Degree of Freedom blog readers will know that Heroes comes up frequently as an example of an online course succeeding in the MOOC medium, one that really stands out amidst a sea of other courses that, while very good, don't really break new ground. Some of the course's unique character can be seen in their video component, which avoids straight sage-on-stage lectures in favor of clips that give you the sense that you're eavesdropping on the intimate conversation between the professor, his colleagues, and students as they dive into key passages of classical texts such as Iliad, Odyssey, the histories of Herodotus, and the plays of Aeschylus and Sophocles. Interestingly, what makes this course work so well in the high-tech medium of the internet is the fact that it is based on the most ancient of all technologies, the written word. Actually, I take that back. For the grounding texts you read during the course, the Iliad and the Odyssey, were originally sung performance pieces, not the books or scrolls that have come down to us through history. And through careful study, we are slowly being pulled into an ancient Greek culture that, while occasionally familiar, is not really like our own. For as Professor Nagy never tires of reminding us, ancient Greece was a song culture, which meant that the stories of Achilles and Odysseus were not just entertainments, but the foundation of a shared culture, a set of oral, sung experiences that provided listeners with what they needed to understand themselves and the human condition. I could say more, but better you hear it from the people who know the subject best. So let's welcome the Greek Hero team to Degree of Freedom.
This is the first group interview I've done, so maybe we could start with everyone introducing themselves and telling us briefly what your role is in the Greek Hero project.
I'm Greg Nagy. I am a professor in the Classics Department at Harvard University. I'm also the director of Harvard's Center for Hellenic Studies in Washington, D.C. I commute every week between Boston and Washington, wearing these two hats. And my priority for, let's say, the next 3 years is to produce a commentary on Homeric poetry with two of my colleagues, Leonard Milner and Douglas Frame. And my other highest priority is to enhance the MOOC, which we affectionately call Heroes X, in every way possible, relying not only on the resources of Harvard and MIT, but also on the resources of Harvard Center for Hellenic Studies.
I'm Jeff Emanuel. I'm the Harvard X Fellow that's responsible for this course, which is an academic way of saying I'm the project manager. I kind of do an air traffic control type position where I manage all the moving parts at these different organizations, Harvard, Harvard X, EdX, and also I just make sure that whatever Greg, Lenny, Claudia, and the team need, hopefully they get and get quickly.
I'm Claudia Phylos. I'm the editor of content and social media for the Ancient Greek Hero. To a large extent, my role is about community building, about helping people to connect around the content. So that happens in several places. It's both through social media accounts, through Facebook, Google+, then also in the discussion for the class, then the actual content of the course.
So I'm Leonard Milner. I'm a professor of classical studies at Brandeis University. I'm the director for information technology and publications at the Center for Hellenic Studies in Washington. And my title for this course is the chair of the board of readers, which means that I have intellectual and administrative functions. The intellectual part is talking with Greg, not only in the videos, but in general about how the course is running. I'm working with Claudia, so I do time answering posts and trying to contribute to the discussion.
I gather the philosophy behind the class, the teaching the Greek Hero in 24 hours, predates the idea of delivering it as a massive online class. Can you talk a little bit about how the structure developed?
I think a key element is the flipped classroom, which is something that we have been experimenting with for some time. The other thing is to de-emphasize the idea of the professor as the leader teacher and to play up the importance of dialogue with students, or as I like to say, fellow learners. I no longer even like to say this course, students in the course, but this project and participants in the project. But maybe Jeff could say more about how we went from a Gen Ed course, affectionately known as Day Heroes, and a DCE course, Division of Continuing Education course, affectionately known as Night Heroes, into this new mode, which is Heroes X.
It was an interesting undertaking, and we've been working on it for several months now. But one of the keys was, this is the longest continuously running course at Harvard, I believe. It's been about 38 years. It's been a core curriculum course. It started out as a small group meeting that Greg and Lenny had, and went all the way up through being a general education core course with 10,000 alumni. It's been an extension course for at least 30 years?
Yes, almost as long as the Day Heroes, yes.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of tradition. And one thing that was very important to the team as a whole was to make sure the spirit and consistency and integrity of that program carried over into the open online version of that course, from content to what's focused on and what students or participants get out of it. Greg and Lenny and Claudia and the team have worked so hard to make sure that in every way that can be consistently done and done similarly to the way it's done in residence here, the Harvard experience, that carries over. Aside from things like assessment, where it's difficult to get long writing assignments in and graded from classes this size, there's been a very, very consistent feel to it.
And other than assessment, have there been any other challenges in bringing this class to such a huge audience?
There have been a lot of challenges. Most of them we'd file under expected challenges. Mm-hmm. This is the first humanities course that edX and HarvardX in this partnership have ever offered. But one thing that we're really doing here is we've been building the airplane and flight as we go. As seamless as it hopefully appears, this course is being developed as it's being offered. So there have been a lot of fun challenges, but that's part of being a trailblazer.
I think that was so beautifully said, Jeff, because this is the first time we're doing this, and because, let's just say, we're building the ship as we're sailing it instead of flying the airplane as we fly it. A little friendlier. I am dying to give this course again, ASAP, preferably in the fall. I'm also dying to make it possible for people who were participants this time to be able to do it again. To me, that would be the ideal course where, let's say, somebody like you, John, does it again.
I just wanted to add something to what Jeff said, which is the other thing that's been amazing is the way the participants have been responding to the fact that things aren't working always the way they should. Yeah. And mm-hmm. they've been amazingly helpful in pointing stuff out to us, patient, and the community formation that Claudia has taught us all to be agents of is so real and such a life-affirming thing for us.
Were there a willingness by participants now or at any time to participate again, they'd get a really clear message that this isn't any kind of a static project at all.
If I recall, the Romans, I presume the ancient Greeks, broke the day into 12 hours a day and 12 hours a night, regardless of what time of the year it was, meaning that an hour during the summer solstice was much longer than what you call an hour today. So with that in mind, I was wondering if you're using some similar system for measuring time.
Yes.
I don't
yes.
think a single component of this class has been less than an hour.
Some have been almost three, right?
So, John, I think the best metaphor to reassure you and to reassure all the 31,000 who originally made contact is the model is Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, which starts with broad narrative frames and then gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And by the time you get to the end of Dr. Strangelove, it's like 2 minutes, 1 minute, 30 seconds. And that's really the way it is. And even if you look at the parts, you know, the first part takes forever. Second part, still forever. But then the third and the fourth and the fifth, they start really going very fast. And when we're doing films now, the stakes get higher and higher. Process of absorption gets more and more concentrated. And I think we'll go out with a real bang.
And no Slim Pickens and nuclear bomb.
Well, we're on the subject of film. You've inserted a lot of modern films and classical film into the subject. I can tell it's not just to give your fellow learners something to connect to. There's like a sense of film passion.
Oh, a all-consuming passion. The best is where you can have a medium like classical opera, Mozart's Magic Flute, and then preferably a really good film director like Ingmar Bergman, and put it all together, and then you get this multimedia exposure to something that is very ancient, very modern, and thousands of things to compare with. The beauty of it is, well, no, let me put it in terms of Plato's theory of forms, okay? So there's the idea of a sympodic couch, then there's the sympodic couch that the carpenter makes, and then there's the sympodic couch that the painter paints. By the time you get to that third step removed, it's no longer the art of making a couch. Mm-hmm. It's simply an art that responds to another art, so it's not the same thing. And what's the term, dear Jeff? Transformative. Transformative.
Yes.
It is that if we participants have a dialogue about something that happens in the Kubrick film, that's transformative.
We have folks whose whole job it is in the legal department here to make sure that we can understand and adhere to fair use in the mm-hmm. current definition legally, to make sure we can present things like a couple clips of Blade Runner that are
yes.
so comparatively important here, or Kurosawa, or some other films.
Excellent examples.
We're trying to make sure that it's very clear what the pedagogical use of these clips is within the course, and then from there we can show them. And yeah. there's no way that Greg was going to let us, if there was a way to do it, not do it, because that really is a passion. It's so comparative. And it's so key to understanding in the modern world yeah. what's going on in these ancient texts.
And it seems like this is one of the few courses I've taken that is trying to do something different visually than yes. point the camera at the professor.
I'd love to speak to that first. As somebody who's been a consumer of distance education, non-traditional education in the past, along with traditional ed, one thing that I feel very, very strongly about is getting away from the traditional, non-traditional model of lecture capture, very clear, outsider, insider, this is Harvard, or you name the school, you're not here, but enjoy watching something you can't participate in. And so what this team as a whole is incredibly passionate about, shares that passion with me 100%, is intimate insider experience. Somebody who is 2,000, 10,000 miles away is participating in this as fully and getting as intimate and as personalized an experience, we hope, as someone who is in the Night Heroes class or is in the brick and mortar class. And we've really made an effort to do that, to really make sure that we're blurring that line so that even though you're not physically here, you don't feel like you're being excluded. And that's something that goes into every single aspect of what we do for this course.
I don't know if you've seen some of the comments on the board, and I'm so fascinated by this, where people really talk about how they feel connected. So you feel connected to the tradition, you feel connected to what's happening, and then I think people do feel a sense of connection with each other.
The way Claudia finds things on the discussion board, and you average how many really good ones per week, let's say?
Oh, I mean, there are tons of good ones every
yes.
week. The ones I send you, I show great restraint in what I send to
yes.
you guys.
There's this one example where this woman writes, and she says, I was born in money, and money is a part of the Greek mainland that was still pagan in the 10th century or something.
Well, it's the Greek it's the island part of Greece, right? It's on the Peloponnesus.
Well, it's Peloponnesus, yes. And it's very independent, fiercely independent. That's the cliche. Mm-hmm. And so this woman says, well, in my community, we still do laments. And then I was just looking around to see what illustrates best the kind of laments that I experienced. And then she points us to mm-hmm. YouTube. YouTube is this eight-minute sequence, dark room, and there's the corpse of old grandfather, and there's old grandmother crying and singing at the same time, singing and crying, and caressing the face of grandfather, and everybody else is weeping and singing. And you think, well, is this going to be some kind of exploitation? And at the end, there's a voiceover, and it has subtitles. I am the grandson of this grandfather, and I did this to honor him and I dedicate this to him. And so the whole thing comes together so beautifully. I was so moved that all of this happened through Claudia's interaction as content editor. And so we're not just building community, we're finding parts of ourselves.
It's a nice example of how people are making connections and connecting to their own experience and sharing with others.
I think, you know, this is Greg and Lenny's vision about how to have a meaningful intellectual experience.
Yeah.
I think you have the most interesting intellectual experiences in the context of people who you're in a meaningful relationship with.
Started talking before about the time you're putting into those assessment quizzes at
yes,
the end of each.
Yes, yes.
And got to the point where I feel like each week I'm engaged in a battle of wits with the entire team. And you said that's the most time-consuming piece of the project.
It is. I'd like to say that it gets shorter and shorter, but, for example, the last time I had a really strict deadline from Jeff, and I realized,
This is the annotation exercise.
Yeah, this is the annotation exercise.
Short answers and the others.
And I should tell you that the first one I did was like a tricycle experience because Lenny walked me through it. It took me a while to figure out how to frame it, etc. So the first one is by Lenny and me, but then he said, all right, look, you wrote the book, so you do the next one. So then I had to go to a bicycle stage, and that one took even longer than 6 hours. That might have been 12 hours. It's just really nerve-wracking. But I really wanted to get to the basics of it and what you take away, and not to make the other alternative answers worthless. But one of them is always sort of retelling what there is, which is good. That's point one. Another one is reading into it. That's always the point zero. And then something where you really connect dots and contextualize. And I have to do another one after this interview. And I just know I have to spend the rest of the day doing it.
I'm the one who's responsible, not for writing all the questions, but for we're generating the short answer questions.
Well, even those, I sort of knew I was getting into something interesting. Actually, the very first question, the first test, because I come from a professional testing background.
Oh my God.
The first thing I looked at is, well, they're doing everything wrong. It's multiple choice. There's only three answers. There should be four. Yeah. And they're using none of the above, which is like, you never do that. But then I proudly picked Agamemnon and got it wrong. Got me thinking, well, you know, what he's really trying to make me realize is that not only am I wrong, Apollo was angry first, but Apollo's a character in the story. He's not my current thing where the gods are distant figures. He's a living character in the story.
I love it. You know, when Wolfgang Petersen was interviewed after he made the Brad Pitt version of
Troy,
he specifically said that he deliberately omitted the gods as characters in the film. And that was because of the archaeologist that he was under the influence of, because the archaeologist was treating the Iliad as some kind of database for what really happened in 1100 BCE. You know?
I was going to ask you about the Brad Pitt version of Troy, since I just watched it in anticipation of this interview. Did they have llamas back then?
but you know, that's typical of myth, that if myth is saying, let's say, about Dionysus, that he looks foreign, okay, then every generation will have different ways of interpreting what foreign is. So the 5th century will be earrings and whatever.
And reading other people who talk about teaching the classics, those are two messages I often hear. You can't really think like an ancient Greek unless you speak ancient Greek. And then also the notion that there are too few people teaching this and too few people interested in it. I'm getting the sense from 30,000 people enrolled in this class that neither of those is really the case.
Yeah, not at all. Yeah. And could I say, if you ever have a chance to speak to two wonderful colleagues in Harvard's classics department, Emma Dench and Mark Shefsky, one of the things that those two and I, as their colleague in Harvard's classics department, would like to do eventually is build modules into a course like Heroes, or in the case of Emma, the Roman Empire, where there's a language learning component and where you try to pick up the basics of the language on the basis of the specific areas of interest that you're reading, right, that are being translated very carefully. So, for example, all the passages that we give you, those are very carefully translated by yours truly, where I really watch for every syllable. And actually, if you look at the glossary of key words at the end, you end up knowing about 150 words. And so you, even in the present iteration, learning some basic things about the Greek language. But imagine if we went after people like you more aggressively and say, hey, if you're doing all this work, why not pick up the rudiments of the syntax? And instead of 150 words, how about 1,500 words? Then you'd really be there. So just tell your people that the idea that classics is moribund is just not the case. So there's a real hunger for that world, not because it's ancient, but because so many of the human experiences, although in some ways they're understandable to us, in other ways are so different. So you get a much more broad view of what humanity is. And humanity is not as narrow as we sometimes think.
Well, this has been a wonderful experience. I want to thank everybody for spending time.
And so I hope we continue the conversation.
As we close out this week's episode, I want to make note of the fact that as much as I admire Greek Hero, there's nothing they do with their successful course that can't be replicated by others looking to breathe life into an otherwise conventional MOOC. For instance, the video camera could do something more than just shoot a single person talking from the stage. In Professor Naj's case, he's got more than one camera doing the shooting and they're filming dialogues versus monologues. But that's just one example of doing something different versus the kind of stilted cinematography we've come to expect in video-based courses. I have taken other classes where teachers get out of the classroom or include media from third-party sources, but often this is just repurposed material, some of it shot for classroom projects, or clip art that served to distract rather than add to a presentation. In a way, the MOOCs I've taken remind me of the first rock videos that appeared during the infancy of MTV, an era when anyone who could borrow their parents' camcorder could be guaranteed a spot on the network. But then Michael Jackson brought Hollywood-level production values to videos such as Thriller, redefining the medium forever. And while I'm not looking for the Greek Hero team to sprout werewolf fangs or break into lightsaber duels for my amusement, I suspect that the success of future MOOC blockbusters will depend on who is willing to take a chance and do something both experimental and professional with the visual language of online learning. I should also note that Greek Hero, like many of my other classes, grades students on their ability to answer a handful of automatically scored multiple-choice questions each week. But as you heard during our discussion, these questions are not just repurposed classroom quizzes or afterthoughts with obvious answers, but are carefully crafted items, some taking almost an hour to write, designed to work as hard as a multiple-choice question can. This is just one more example of how the magic of a MOOC can come out of not reinventing everything from the ground up, but by simply doing all the things needed for an online course, lectures, assessment, reading lists, communication forms, etc., as well as possible, given the limitations of the new technology and the fact that you may be teaching 30,000 or more people at a time. And with that, I'd like to say goodbye, but I hope you'll be able to join us next week on the next Degree of Freedom podcast.